Emotions, Chapter 9. We do many things with language. There are some examples. But two important things that we do with language are convey information and evoke feelings from other people. So we can talk about that in terms of the cognitive meaning of the language. This is what it means. This is the propositional content. This is the information. And emotive meaning. These are the kind of feelings that this type of language generates. Logic and critical thinking are concerned with cognitive meaning. The problem is that much language has emotive meaning, so it's important to be able to distinguish the cognitive meaning from the emotive meaning. Here's an example of a couple of paragraphs about the same issue. And one is leaning more on the cognitive meaning side, and the other leans more on the emotive meaning side. First example, death penalty, which is legal in 36 states, has been carried out most often in Georgia. However, since 1977, Texas holds the record for the greatest number of executions. Now compare that with this. The death penalty is a cruel and inhuman form of punishment in which hapless prisoners are dragged from their cells and summarily slaughtered only to satiate the bloodlust of a vengeful public. Now it's obvious that the second is at least slightly more emotionally charged than the first. So why do people use such kind of language? Well, one reason that it is not the only reason, but one reason is that you can get people to agree with your conclusion by swaying them in particular ways, and if you can do that, maybe you won't have to offer evidence in support of the claim. So the effect of such language in arguments is that it tends to allow people to make value claims without evidence, or maybe cut off potential objections before they're made. I have a friend who used to say some things like, "You're not one of those idiots that believes dot, dot, dot." Well, if you're intimidated by that, you're not going to say, "Well, yes, I am one of those idiots." So the emotional language may tend to put us in a particular frame of mind where we don't think about the cognitive content very much. So in order to counter all of these effects, what we have to do is to be able to disengage the cognitive from the emotive. Okay, we're going to talk about some fallacies that have to deal with appeals to emotion. Appeal to pity, scare tactics, apple polishing, and appeal to anger. First is appeal to pity. This is where you generate some emotion of pity to get someone to agree to something because they feel sorry about a particular thing. Now, in order for this to be a fallacy, the pity has to be irrelevant to the truth of the claim that's made. Here's an example. Student says, "I deserve an A because my mother's very ill, and I had to spend most of my time caring for her this semester." Well, that's certainly a good reason for you to feel sorry for the particular student, but that's irrelevant to whether or not the student deserves an A or not. Second is scare tactics. This is a threat. So you accept a claim because of a threat, either an explicit threat, "I will do this to you," or an implicit threat. Again, the threat has to be irrelevant to the truth of the claim. Student says, "I deserve an A because my father's on the board of trustees." So again, that's irrelevant. It is a threat. This is common in advertising. Example would be you need to, if you don't use this particular brand of deodorant, then here's what's going to happen to you. Won't have any friends, so on. Or in politics, right? If my opponent is elected, then everything is going to go down the tubes. Another fallacy is called appeal to the people. Okay, this is an example of that is a bandwagon fallacy that we already talked about. Everybody does this, so you need to do it also. appeal to vanity. If you do this, other people will admire you. So if you buy this product, you'll be admired. If you use this particular brand of cologne, right, everyone will like you. Which is slightly different from the appeal to snobbery. The appeal to snobbery says essentially that not everybody can do this thing. Not everybody can have this. Not everybody can own this. A good example is Trump Tower in New York. If you read Donald Trump's biography, I believe it was titled The Art of the Deal, he says that when he built Trump Tower, that the Guggenheim also, there were some apartments that were, or condominiums that were being built by the Guggenheim. And he said the ones at the Guggenheim were that's a better location, they were nicer, they had all these things going for them, and they were cheaper than the ones at Trump Tower. So Donald Trump priced his for $1 million, and you could get one of those for a measly $800,000 or something like that. Well, Donald Trump sold his. They're having trouble selling the ones at the Guggenheim, but Trump's were sold out. Why is that the case if the others were so much better? Well, it's everyone wanted to be known as the people who had the million-dollar condo, who lived in the million-dollar place. So it's simply an appeal to snobbery. Appeal to anger. You commit the appeal to anger when you substitute anger for a reason when you take a particular side on an issue. So you get other people to feel angry about a particular thing and then use that as a reason for believing a particular claim. The example that's listed here is that this defendant must be guilty. Look at all these horrible pictures at the crime scene. Well, the horrible pictures of the crime scene have absolutely nothing to do with the defendant's guilt. So it's irrelevant at the time of determining whether the person is guilty or not guilty. Now, it is relevant at a particular point later on, right, when you determine just what sentence does this person deserve once they're already found guilty. It's certainly relevant then, but not relevant before. Here's some self-serving biases. These will come up later in the semester, too. First is wishful thinking. Wishful thinking is when we believe something, not because we have good reason to believe it, but because we want it to be true. So somebody who believes that this lottery ticket's going to be the winner, well, they've got absolutely no reason to believe that it's true, but they simply want it to be. Or a defense mechanism. A defense mechanism is when we believe something as a way of protecting our own self-perception or self-esteem. So I know that maybe I did this thing that was wrong, but I'll block that out of my mind and believe that I really am a good person. Or rationalization. Very often we don't have good reasons for believing something before the fact, but we do it anyway. Then we have to make up good reasons after the fact. So when you rationalize something, you're finding reasons that justify that action after you've already done it. Appeal to common practice says that this thing must be true, it must be good, it must be okay because everyone does it or everyone believes it. For example, everybody does this, so there must be nothing wrong with it. Two wrongs make a right. This thing is the right thing for me to do, even though I know that it's wrong. It's right for me to do because it's been done to me. So I'm just getting revenge, in a sense. One thing that we may talk about later, I don't remember, is the Lake Wobegon effect. Garrison Keillor has this radio show on National Public Radio, and the introduction starts off to he's got this fictional town named Lake Wobegon, and the closing of the Lake Wobegon episode goes something like this: Lake Wobegon, where the men are good-looking, the women are strong, and all the children are above average. The Lake Wobegon effect, then, is the tendency to think that we are above average. It turns out that, in fact, the book I think talks about this. There's a study of high schoolers, and remarkable 80% of high schoolers rated themselves as being above average. Something on the next slide. 70% of 1 million high school students rated themselves as above average in leadership. Only 2% rated themselves as below average. 90% of drivers think they're above average drivers. 94% of college professors think they're above average teachers. Now, if average means anything, you know that this can't be right. So, if it's a nice bell curve, then roughly half will be above average. Roughly half will be at average or below. Now, interestingly enough, it turns out that this bias that we have leads us to believe that that we're better than average in all the good ways, right? So since it's bad to be a biased, our bias to believe that we're better than average leads us to believe that we're less biased on average than other people. So, given all this stuff, given how you know that emotions affect people, one good question to ask is, what should be my strategy when I'm trying to persuade somebody of something? Well, if your audience is perfect, they're not going to be swayed by the emotive content. They're going to be swayed by good reasons. So, for a perfect audience, the best persuasion is just simply good argumentation. Unfortunately, most audiences are not perfect. They're imperfect. So here's some things to keep in mind for an imperfect audience. The first is to be able to anticipate objections that can be made to your position. If you anticipate those objections, then you can address them early. If there are views that oppose yours, disagreements, you should speak sympathetically of those opposing views. Don't trash them. Don't tear them down. If you treat them with respect, then you're going to come off looking a lot better in the end. Concede the minor points. So if it's not going to make that much difference, just go ahead and grant it. You've got nothing to lose. It's not going to make any difference anyway. And, of course, that's going to make you seem better. That's going to put people in a better emotional frame of mind with respect to your position. If you don't have a response to a particular objection, then try to minimize that objection. If you can try to make it seem less important, you're better off that way. Avoid ad hominems. Maybe the next lecture we'll talk about what an ad hominem is. But an ad hominem is an attack against a person. So attacking other people is not the way to put other people in a good emotional frame of mind with respect to your position. Focus on the important issues and let the non-important issues go by. Okay, address objections early on. So, if you address objections early on, then people won't have as long to think about those objections and what would constitute a good response to those objections. So, if you know that there are objections to your position, go ahead and address them, get them out of the way. If your position is strong, then open with your best argument. So if your position is not so strong, then end with your best argument. Okay, it's morally wrong to use race and gender biases. It's also against your best interest, purely from a critical reasoning position. So that's not going to help you developing a emotional contact with your audience. And mainly because of that, if there are particular groups, you don't want to offend anybody, so don't mention groups unless they happen to be relevant to the chain of reasoning that you have. Okay, non-argumentative persuasion. Here are a lot of different ways to persuade somebody, so you need to be aware of these, not so much to commit them, but to keep them from being committed against you. These are different ways to affect the beliefs of a person without good reasons or reasons at all. These examples of non-argumentative persuasion work, and they work a lot of times because they suggest more than what they really say. Slanters. Slanters are words or phrases that are emotively charged. A slanter can have a positive connotation or it can have a negative connotation. If it has a positive connotation, we call it a euphemism. So a euphemism is a synonym for a neutral word, and that synonym has a positive emotive content. So examples are pre-owned cars, which is a euphemism for a used car, or putting the dog to sleep or putting the dog down, a euphemism for killing the dog. Euphemisms are really popular in the military. Military talk about taking out a soft target as opposed to killing a person. Retrograde operations, which is a euphemism for a retreat, or friendly fire, which is a euphemism for accidentally being killed by your own people. Now, euphemisms can have good uses as a way of encouraging discussion. So sometimes it's nice to talk about things in softer, gentler terms when people would be put off by a more neutral term. A dysphemism is a synonym that has a negative emotive content. It's the opposite of a euphemism. Thugs and bodyguards, sort of guerrillas and freedom fighters, right, so on. Now, neutral language can serve as a euphemism or a dysphemism if it's replacing language that would ordinarily be used. So in this example, delivery system is neutral. Neutral language, it's a neutral synonym for missile, which has a kind of negative connotation. Okay, stereotypes. There's a whole chapter later on in the semester on stereotypes, but stereotypes are emotional associations that are connected to a whole group of people. We won't talk about them much now. Innuendos imply something by what you don't say. They suggest something while claiming not to say anything about this. There are examples in literature about condemning somebody with faint praise. So, in fact, you can do this in writing a reference letter for somebody. If you write a reference letter and the person who reads it expects you to say that this is just the greatest person that we've ever had, and you say something that's only mildly positive, it's going to come across as something that's pretty bad. Well, before I go on to the loaded question, an example of an innuendo would be two politicians in a debate, and one politician says, "I'm not going to accuse my opponent of embezzling funds from his last campaign." Well, he says he's not going to do it, but by just even making that statement, he implied that there is someone who's making such an accusation. Okay, a loaded question suggests something with a question. So it's really a combination of two different questions. A question is a loaded question if you can't answer it without admitting something that you wouldn't want to admit. Example here is, when will you stop cheating on exams? So that question calls for a particular time. Right, I will cheat, I'll stop today, or I'll stop tomorrow. But either way, you admit to having cheated on exams. Another example will be something like this: Are you still cheating on exams? Well, that kind of question calls for either a yes answer or a no answer. If you answer yes, you admit to having done it in the past and you're still doing it. If you answer no, you're not doing it now, but you still admit to having done it in the past. A weaseler is a word that qualifies a claim in order to make it very difficult to prove you wrong. Weaselers are words and phrases like might or perhaps or up to or it's possible that. You get a lot of these in advertising. So if you listen to commercials a lot, you'll notice they'll say things like if you buy our product, you will save up to $50 a month, something like that. Well, up to $50 a month means any value up to $50. It just simply means no more than $50. And zero is no more than $50. So if you buy it and you don't save any money at all, you can't accuse them of lying to you. So a down player is different from a weaseler. A down player is a word that makes something seem less important than it is. So we talk about something being a so-called solution to a problem or something like that, right? Or this is merely such and such, right? And when you do that, you make it seem like it's not really much of a solution, or it's not really much of a proposal. So sometimes we put it in scare quotes. It implies the same thing. Proof surrogate is when you imply that there's proof, but there's not. So the most common proof surrogate is to say that studies show, or they say, whoever they are, right? Presumably they are somebody who knows, but we're not really told who they are or what the studies are. Or sometimes they'll say, another example of a proof surrogate is to say that, well, it's obviously true that, well, it may not be obviously true, but it may be just the case that I know it's not obviously true, but I'm hoping that you'll believe it's obviously true if I say it is. So it's obvious that John McCain cannot win the Republican primary. Well, that may not be so obvious. Okay, what goes on here, why it's called a proof surrogate, is it looks like you're offering real proof, but you're really not. You're just making an assertion that's standing in for this proof that is supposedly there. A hyperbole is an extreme exaggeration. It's sort of out of place, where you say that this is, maybe you see some movie, a movie my daughter watched, Napoleon Dynamite. If I say Napoleon Dynamite is the greatest film ever made in the history of film, that's a slight exaggeration. All right, so it's an inappropriate exaggeration. You need to be careful about these. It's actually pretty easy to spot a hyperbole when it's committed. Right, this is an exaggeration, it's out of place, they're making too much of this. The danger is that in a lot of cases a person will make this extreme claim and then they'll back off. When they back off, we're much more inclined to accept the second version, the weaker version that they made. So if I make this claim that, Napoleon Dynamite was the greatest film ever made, and then I say, oh no, that's really not true. But it was really good. Once I make the weaker version of the claim, you're much more likely to accept it because you're contrasting it with the first one, with the exaggerated version. Okay. We get a lot of these things in terms of the media. So questions to ask are, how objective are the media? Well, here are some issues. One, how do they select these stories? Well, they select the stories based on what people want to hear because they have a significant profit motive. You have to get good ratings. You get good ratings, then you'll be able to get advertising dollars. So this translates into its tendency to want to please the audience. Advertising relies very, very heavily on non-argumentative persuasion. So advertising works by getting us to have particular desires, a desire to buy a particular product. So we always need to ask, does this ad provide a good reason to buy the product? Now, we've already seen plenty of reasons to disregard particular advertising. So let's say celebrity endorsements. That's a claim of a fallacious appeal to expertise, right? So a celebrity endorses a particular product. They're a celebrity, so given the halo effect, it gets us to confer certain other expertise upon them. Therefore, we're more willing to buy this product just because so-and-so says that it's good, even when they have no expertise in that at all. And that's the end of this section on emotions, and I believe the next chapter is the one on fallacies.